This is Defy These Times, and I'm your host, Joey Ayoub. In this third season, we will be exploring internationalist solidarity, prefigurative politics, solarpunk, and how to tackle some of the most pressing challenges of our times. Each episode will be on one or more of these topics. But before getting into today's topic, I wanted to quickly tell you that you can support this podcast for as little as $2 or $5 a month on patreon.com/firethesetimes. That is patreon.com/firethesetimes. If you cannot donate, you can still support by sharing it with your friends and families and leaving a review wherever you listen to podcasts. This helps it get more exposure and introduce it to more folks. That's it from me today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. So hello everyone and welcome to Defy These Times. I am your host, Joey Ayoub. Today we'll be talking with three folks, two who kind of be co-hosts slash guests, and of course Tenmori, the main guest of this conversation. Tenmori Soundararajan, if I'm hoping you pronounce it right, is the author of the book The Trauma of Caste, A Dalit Feminist Meditation on Survivorship, Healing and Abolition, which is a phenomenal book. As I think listeners to this podcast will agree by the end of this conversation, I really highly recommend listening to it, listening to the episode first and maybe then reading the book or vice versa, up to you guys. So I'll just ask each of you if it's okay to introduce yourselves. Tenmori, if you want, can you start?
Sure. So my name is Tenmori Soundararajan, and I'm a Dalit civil rights activist and an artist and a technologist and general troublemaker. And I am the author of the book, The Trauma of Caste, and very excited to kind of get into the conversations related to how we look at the problem of caste and how we heal from it.
So, hi, my name is Ridhima, and I am an Indian. I come from Mumbai, and I'm a Dalit. And I, while reading Tenmori's book, it was a healing journey in itself. So I'm very grateful to be here on this this talk. Thanks, Joey. And I've been working as a PhD student. Right now I'm in Zurich, and I'm doing my PhD in environmental policy. I have an organization in environmental and social justice, which we started out of Zurich, and it's based in working on cross-border projects across India. And yeah, right now I'm here to just learn and discuss more on this journey of healing.
So my name is Vivek. I also am from India. So I come from a dominant caste South Indian family, and I'm gender non-binary. I have pronouns he and him. For me, Tenmori's book was truly one of the most. It was one of the most revelatory books, and I think on multiple levels, it was transformative. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful to her, and I am deeply grateful to Joey for allowing me to be part of this conversation. So I work as a postdoctoral researcher at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. And my work is focused on finding ways to teach ethics to engineering students, particularly computer science students who tend to have a lot of power in the world today. And I try to teach ethics to them through moral sensitivity, reasoning, and empathy.
Well, thanks a lot. And thank you, well, the three of you for being here. Funnily enough, I think this is the most Switzerland I've had on this podcast, which is very random. Okay, let's start. There's something that, Tenmori, that you wrote at the beginning of the book, at the start of The Trauma of Caste, that reminded me of something that James Baldwin said. And this podcast is at least partly named after one of his books, Defy Next Time. This is Defy These Times. And so whenever I can, I bring him into the conversation because he helps me think. So he says this about being Black in America. And I think this will help us having a comparative analysis at some point down the line throughout this conversation. And so it was part of one of the interviews that he was doing, and he said that he never saw himself as a, you know, N-word, which I'm obviously not going to say, because no such person exists. There's no person who's actually actually exist like that. It's a category. And this category was entirely created by white people who enslaved his ancestors. That was kind of the argument he was making. And therefore, he concluded, and he would make this argument time and time again, that it is up to them, i.e. in this case, white people, to figure out why they needed to create the quote-unquote N-word in the first place. And I'm personally fascinated by the politics of language. So like throughout reading this book, I was always thinking, like, what does it even mean to use one term instead of the other? And what happens when that term isn't used, right? And it also a bit random at first maybe, but in certain religions, namely in Christianity and Islam, at least some denominations of the two, in the practice of exorcism, which regardless whether people believe it or not, there's something very interesting that happens, which is that always the first step is that the demon that supposedly possesses the human has to be identified. So like the priest or the whatever, the cleric, whatever, would essentially force the demon to say, "My name is." And as soon as that happens, supposedly this creates a way in into the individual who is being possessed to reclaim their identity. And I find that that's and when you reclaim your identity, that's when you're able to reject the demon, because in that idea and that mythology, you cannot reject the demon unless you want to, essentially. Conversely, if we use that metaphor, which we don't have to, I'm just using it for my own purposes, not naming something which should be named is a way of rendering invisible something which ought to be invisible. And so in the context of this conversation, in the case of Dalits, of course, the derogatory term, and here I'm going to use quote-unquote untouchable, which used to be more common, but from what I understand is still used in certain contexts, is literally that, because like, to be untouchable, again, quote unquote, is also to be unthinkable, like not to be talked to, not to be thought about. You know, it's almost like it's an all encompassing project of erasure, which is obviously is an act of violence. So to start with language itself, if this can kind of anchor us, if it's okay, Tenmori, can you kind of talk to us a bit about, where does the word Dalit come from, and why does it matter to use that word?
So I think naming, which is what you're referring to, Joey, is very powerful. In many ways, like when we don't give words to our oppression, we live in this liminal state of where violence is occurring, but we can't speak to our conditions of pain. And I think that in terms of one of the reasons why I wrote this book is that for the South Asian community, there's a deep taboo of talking about caste, naming how virulent and pervasive it is in our communities, both in our homelands and in the diaspora, and to use the appropriate terms that speak to the gravity of the desecration of bodies, minds, and spirits. So it is like naming is actually the first part of freedom, you know, because you can't actually solve a problem if you don't recognize it's a problem, and you can't recognize it's a problem if you don't use words to say what it is, right? So for your audience that has never heard about the term caste or the term Dalit, you know, caste is a system of exclusion that has its origins from 2000 BC in Hindu scripture. You know, it's set up, it's based on a social fiction where a group of people that wrote these scriptures, the Brahmins, divided up society on differing layers of spiritual purity. And every caste or class was given a profession. That profession was given, you know, a grade of spiritual purity and therefore the access and opportunities they have in life. So you have Brahmins who are at the top, Kshatriyas who are the rulers and the kings. You have Vaishyas, who are the merchants, the Shudras, who are the peasants. And then outside of that whole caste pyramid are those that were deemed spiritual criminals. People who had done crimes in past lives and were seen as wretched and therefore deserving of being born as untouchable or spiritually defiling to other people because of those crimes, and therefore should be given the worst of backbreaking labor, needed to be cordoned off and shunned and lived in a different part of the village or town, and, you know, experience deep abiding violence and structural exclusion. And those communities do not like to use the term untouchable. You know, as someone who was born in that community, I view that word as an epithet because it's saying that they're defining our spirituality towards God, you know, and no one gets to decide, you know, your spiritual worth before any sort of part of the divine. So many people who come from this caste-oppressed background use the term Dalit instead, which means, you know, one who has been broken but is resilient. Or they might use the term caste-oppressed. They might also use the term Bahujan, which is like an encompassing term for all of the caste-oppressed communities that include untouchables, but might also include Shudras, and also another category, which I didn't get to speak about, the indigenous people who are Adivasis, or they might just identify as their religious, you know, community, or just say that I'm human, you know. And the reason why there's such a diversity of naming is because so much of choice and consent is removed in the construction of these systems of exclusion, whether it's white supremacy or the caste system. And so, you know, there is no one way to be caste oppressed. And so allowing people to choose their pathway of how they liberate themselves, the naming, you know, is really quite important. And so I always feel like it's really important to just meet folks where they're at. If whatever people want to call themselves, it's that is their self-determined right. But for the purposes of law and for the purposes of how people understand the civil rights struggles around caste, usually, you know, people understand Dalits to be the caste-oppressed people who are the most targeted by caste discrimination wherever it might lie.
Thanks a lot for giving us this very important background. For a lot of my listeners, I'm not entirely sure always of the demographics of folks listening, but I would assume that many folks, if not most folks, have heard of caste and maybe, you know, consequently of casteism, but they don't quite know how does it work, because there are certain isms, right? If we talk about racism, sexism, misogyny, and so on, even transphobia, that sometimes you might have like some visual markers, like, oh, you know, the way you present to the world, maybe the color of your skin or whatnot. So how does this translate when it comes to casteism? That's probably too big of a question, but like, just what can you tell us about it, just to kind of ground this conversation a bit?
So I think what's important to know is that, you know, caste as it operates in many contexts has certain social locators. You know, it might be someone's last name. It might be the food that they eat. It might be the religion that they practice. Because certain traditions, like if you say that you're a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim in some context, people will know you to be Dalit because people have converted into those traditions to escape the original formation of caste. But I will say that caste is now found in all communities of religious practice. So that's not always like a good indicator, but you know, it can be sometimes. Also, I think whether or not your family is a landowner or a family that works the land, I think other contexts also, you know, might also be really helpful to look at is the ways that, you know, people's like kind of histories of are they open or are they outed about their caste identity or are they closeted? Because almost every dominant caste person I know is very open about being dominant caste. Oh, I'm a Rajput. I am a Brahmin. I am an Iyer, you know. But every Dalit person I know, like 90% of the Dalits I know are closeted in their workplaces, in their community institutions, at their religious institutions. So that's another big marker as well. But the bottom line is that while these are important for us as we interact socially, when it comes to the issue of caste as a protected category in workplaces or educational institutions, how this gets like decided in the diaspora is that, you know, if harm occurs, that's like, let's say some sort of caste discrimination happens, whenever someone's making a complaint, they would then identify themselves as a member of that protected category. And then that would trigger in the investigation insight into the harm doer's mindset. Did they know this? Was this part of the process? And then whatever else into like the activity that occurred. So it's important for people to distinguish, like, how do we talk about caste and understand caste socially in our relationships? And then also how caste operates, like, in terms of a form of structural bias in workplaces and institutions, which have a more formal way that you would investigate and understand. understand it. And that would all be like legally informed by lawyers who are looking at the lens of serious workplace harm and civil rights harm.
So I was thinking more on the lines of the movements which are going or which have happened throughout the history or are happening right now or will happen in the future around the activism, around talking and fighting against the Dalit oppression. And we all know that the roots are from South Asia, the Dalit, the whole idea of caste. But at the same time, as your book highlights very well, and I've been following the work of Equality Labs, and there's a lot of work which is showing that how much it's present throughout the world. And my question here is, like, where and how do the movements in the future look like? Like, we had a lot of movements which, like, dating back in 1800s, where right from Savitribai Phule to Ambedkar and everybody who talked about caste, and there have been big reforms. And your work at Equality Labs is one of those big work which is happening. But I'm just wondering what type of this global solidarity in these movements look like, and do you have a vision, or do you see, or can you put some light on what's happening around the world around this? And how do you see this taking form over the course of next decade or so?
Thank you so much for that question. And, you know, what's so interesting to me is that I think that most really good organizers organize where they're at, right? And I was very conscious of the fact that as someone who is a Dalit of the diaspora who grew up in the United States, I saw caste operate here. And I felt like it was a really important thing to build a movement that could speak to American institutions about the kinds of grave discrimination that we saw. And in our work in Equality Labs, like, we've done a lot of research around this. And one of the most kind of shocking pieces was this survey that we worked on in 2016, which, you know, was the first documentation of caste in the diaspora. And we found that 1 in 4 caste oppressed people faced physical and verbal violence. 1 out of 3 educational discrimination, and 2 out of 3 workplace discrimination. So from that pathway, we saw a path to power where we could really try to address the situations deeply that we were seeing in the United States. So we focused on universities, we focused on community organizations, and eventually have gotten to like jurisdictions, you know, working on different ordinances at the city level. And now we've just launched this bill in California. So I think that that has been a really powerful process to see that journey. And in many ways, I think that, you know, just like Ambedkar, you know, the big Dalit civil rights leader who comes, you know, who is not only the architect of the Indian Constitution, but has inspired so many global movements for caste equity, and is definitely someone everyone that's interested in being an anti-caste thinker and organizer should really learn through the giant of his leadership. But what's really interesting, Dr. Ambedkar said, you know, like, if South Asians travel across the world, you know, they will bring caste with them, which is exactly what we've seen. So if dominant caste people have brought caste globally, it's the children of Ambedkar that are building the resistance globally as well. And so I see this movement for caste equity only growing more, because we're in a snowball moment where basically everyone that can have some mobility around this issue are working to add caste as a protected category. And this is more than a symbolic effort. It's a recognition that this is a severe system of discrimination. It's operating in very severe ways in the diaspora, you know, and includes things like wage theft, housing discrimination, you know, coercive control and domestic violence and interpersonal violence context. You know, there are very, very serious consequences to not addressing this problem. And guess what? Everyone except dominant caste bigots agree. You know? That's the funny part, is that there's like a widespread consensus around stopping this violence, which I find really empowering. And I think I wish more caste oppressed people could hear these global advocacy conversations, because we would know we're not alone. We're not alone. And we've been alone fighting this battle in our homelands for a long time because dominant caste networks have tried to silo this conversation. They've tried to sever the global connection of Dalit people from the world and really try to do whatever they can to do smokes and mirrors to just erase the extreme depravity and human rights crimes that caste really represents. And so I think that as we make our own connected relationship to the world, we have so much to offer to the canon of liberation. And that's what I'm really excited about, because more than these political wins, it's the wisdom of Dalit people, of what we've survived and what we've endured, and what are those tools of resilience that we can share with other oppressed peoples to create a really powerful vision of co-liberation. That's what I hope and would like to see.
Thank you so much. This is really powerful just hearing you. And what I'm hearing is also in a way of sharing and opening our stories and coming out of the closets. And I mean, it takes a lot of energy out as a person who has recently started speaking about my own identity. I would say it takes a lot of energy out of you, and you get many comments which are not something you would want to listen from the people you used to know. So understand, but I think this is something really powerful. Thanks for saying that out. maybe moving on to the next part, related to the same question that I asked, like when we are standing up against, or like when there are more of such movements happening from the Dalit community, but at the same time, for example, I'm working in environmental justice movement, and I see there are a lot of movements which are happening from on the social justice from different communities, right, from BIPOC community and so on. And there are a different level of operations which every community has gone through. And sometimes it puts you under a question like, is it the right time that I can express my, like, our own community's operation, or are we getting into some form of an Operation Olympics at a point? And this is a question which comes to at least personally me, that how do you express, or how do you navigate when there are so many important movements happening? And as much as I see that this solidarity between communities can only be the way forward, but at the same time, how do you make sure that you are not taking away the space of someone who has been maybe intergenerationally more oppressed or less oppressed in a given context? So how do you maneuver it across different contexts, and how do you place your own movement in these many movements which are happening today?
Well, I think it's a matter of tactics, and it's also a matter of timing. So, for example, you know, I was a really nerdy kid. So basically what happened as I went to school and, you know, as I came into my own Dalit consciousness, I was so excited to be, you know, a caste abolitionist, I mean, just my little self, because at that time when I was in undergrad, nobody was out and people thought I was like the only Dalit because of how closeted everybody was. And I faced a lot of flack for it, you know, and I found a political home with other BIPOC women of color elders, you know, there, because in the Bay Area, you have elders that are, you know, formerly from the Black Panthers, you have elders who were, you know, who were some of the core writers of the Combahee Collective. I mean, really, like when you think about intersectionality, stunning, 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 you know, leadership. Like it's like a playground. If you want to be a revolutionary at that time, it was incredible to get that kind of support. But I think the thing that was really key for me, I think, in getting that mentorship was, one, people encouraged me to be authentic about my experience and to lean into intersectionality as a Dalit woman, even if it meant that I was in conflict with other South Asians who did not recognize that intersectionality. But they, you know, I had support of elders that did. But also, you know, I made this like very weird decision in my 20s where I was like, you know what? I don't think I'm ready to be a Dalit activist yet. I want to learn about the human condition. First of all, what 25-year-old says that? Who says that? about the human condition. And yet that's exactly what I said when I was in my early 20s. And what I did is I spent close to 8 to 9 years being in solidarity with racial justice movements across the country. And I was there to be a partner. And, you know, I would share, of course, that I come from a Dalit background, but I was there doing communications. I was there, you know, helping voter mobilize. I was there kind of running and participating in marches and logistics, and just carried the water and learned what were their issues, what were the things that really mattered to them, what were their pain points. And as I sat and I understood how their struggles were, like whether it was like folks in the Diné Nation who were struggling against Peabody Coal and the indigenous settler colonialism that had devastated the Navajo community and how they were fighting for a just transition. Or, you know, the way that I met Tarana Burke was I was part of this whole campaign in Selma, Alabama, to get this racist mayor who'd been in power for 30 years and called Martin Luther King, Martin Luther C-O-O-N, you know. And the first day I arrived for that voter registration campaign to get him out, there was a car that was firebombed in the parking lot of the law firm that was coordinating that. And so there's something visibly different when you are sitting in the context of conflict and violence with other social justice movements, where because they've seen you, because they've trusted you, they're willing to extend trust and connection and beloved community back to Dalit people. And I think that that decision, you know, as a young, 20-year-old, that was really wise, because by having that groundwork of relation building, I wasn't just coming to them with transactional solidarity. I wasn't just like saying, hey, there's this Dalit issue happening, can you show up to our movements? I had several years of base building under my belt so that people are like, oh, this isn't just like an issue we don't know a lot about. This is Thin Mori, our kin. This is like her organization who has been there in our hardest times. Of course, we're going to show up. A letter, you got it. You know what? It's like it makes it so much more meaningful because it's not transactional. It's co-liberation.
Wow. It gave me really goosebumps. So thank you. That was really powerful.
Yeah, Thin Mori, you mentioned also like there's an issue of land, right? Like the question of land is a pretty central one, I think, at least in my mind. And there's something very interesting, I think, Ridhima, you'll get into it now, of the parallels between, for example, the indigenous struggle in the US and and the conversation that we're having. And one thing I found very interesting, Ridhima, there was this quote, like, in how Dalits know, and here I'm quoting, how Dalits know what's best for their lands where they have worked on, in between parentheses, enslaved, better than their Brahmin owners. Brahmin is in between parentheses as well, end quote. And what I found very interesting about this framing is that, again, to bring back James Baldwin again, this is very similar to the argument that people who are oppressed in most situations not only know themselves better than the oppressors know them, but often actually know the oppressors better than the oppressors know themselves. And that's something that is, in the context of like the African-American struggle, for example, I think slightly better understood, at least these days, or at least maybe only in my circles, I'm not sure. But I wonder if you can, Ridhima, you can take it from here if you want, kind of bring it also to the question, or connected if you want, to the question of land that you were going to present.
Yeah, sure. It's a good connection point you made, Joy. So I think going from here, I'm also trying to connect. I mean, these are the level of intersectionalities we are bringing in here. And I think the next level is about the work on caste and environment, which was really something very close to my heart when I was reading it. And because lately, after this IPCC report has come in this week, actually, and I've been just, I think there is a lot of doom and gloom, and there is a lot of climate grief associated to it. And it's relating very close to the grief of land, the grief of being a Dalit as well, where the land is taken away, or you're enslaved on the land, or even not even allowed to be enslaved even. So just eliminated from the land. So this brings a question in my mind, like when we are talking about movements, there have been many land rights movements. And if we look at the whole caste system, most of the power comes in form of land, like Brahmins owning a lot of land and Dalits owning nothing and so on and so forth. So I was thinking if these land movements could be associated to something related to land right movements empowering Dalit women and indigenous communities, which can be put at front and which would help in dismantling this informal / formal colonial plantation Brahmin structure which we have in place of land ownership. And so here, I mean, these are many words coming in together, but I don't know how to put like one single word here.
Welcome to the fire this time.
So just trying to understand the decolonizing efforts in farming methods and putting women at the forefront and giving them, who are actually the real farmers of the land everywhere, and like recognizing the people who have been oppressed throughout centuries and giving this a form of land right activism as well, which is actually a climate and Dalit activist movement as well. So I don't know what the question is exactly here, but more of a discussion, I would say here. Yeah.
Well, I think there's like two points. I want to maybe first address like Joey's point first, because I think that's kind of foundational to why we're in this mess around caste. And that has to do with the fact that I think that when we talk about caste, we talk about the consequences of it on Dalit bodies. We don't talk about what's happening for those in the privileged bodies. And I think that was a big reason why I used the term the trauma of caste. And first of all, there are no books about the psychosocial impacts of caste, period. But I'm sure most dominant caste people, when they pick this up, think it's going to be all about Dalit pain. And in fact, it's quite the opposite, you know. And this is really the contribution. And, you know, going back to that question about co-liberation with other BIPOC movements, you know, when I started to write this book at the beginning of, you know, 2020, the thing that I was so struck by was how after years of struggle in the U.S., we were seeing rollbacks of major civil rights, you know, and talking with elders who had spent their whole lives thinking that this was their retirement and watching their entire legacy erased by a racist Supreme Court or erased by a Republican legislature. And feeling those same blowbacks, obviously, in the Dalit community as well, because, you know, there is no place of Dalit assertion where it's not met with extreme gaslighting, bigotry, disinformation, and violence by dominant caste bigoted organizations and individuals. And in that experience, I was trying to go deeper than the words that our opponents were saying and just watching them behaviorally. And, you know, I always remember because I had this big incident last year where I was supposed to speak for Dalit History Month at Google, and our opponents, there were people who wrote in saying, I'm afraid for my life if this person speaks. I'm afraid for my life. And, you know, as far as I know, I have never met anybody who has died from a DEI talk. You know, you guys could tell me differently, but the fact that they evoked the imagery of death. And I heard this again in another advocacy context where we were trying to add caste as a protected category in Santa Clara County. And these people wrote, you know, there's this one woman who says, are you ready to have Santa Clara be ground zero for Hindu genocide? Do you want us to wear our caste on our arms like the Star of David? Are you ready to have the blood of Hindus on your hands? That's what you'll do if you pass this. And what are we talking about? Adding caste as a protected category, right? But if you heard this person, you know, and if you observe them in testimony, which I have for many years, you know, their reaction to the policy that's being suggested is so out of bounds in terms of how they've raised the stakes internally, because their nervous systems are so deeply triggered at the prospect of equity with a caste-oppressed person. But that is their trauma. And that's like, there's a lot of beautiful thinking by indigenous thinkers like, you know, Maria Braveheart and Eduardo Duran, who wrote a lot about intergenerational trauma and how people carry those lineages with them. And Eduardo Duran wrote of this idea called the soul wound, where when, you know, in any given body, you might have pain that is from your lifetimes of experience, but you also have pain that is related to your lineage. So if you're someone who has suffered from indigenous genocide, that will also contribute to your nervous system training. If you're an, you know, someone who was enslaved and has been racialized as Black, you will also have, you know, intergenerational soul wounds related to race and the process of anti-Blackness and enslavement. And Reshma Menakem has really put that work even further in his processes of somatic abolitionism, where he works with people who are in what he calls them, like bodies of culture, bodies of privilege, and Black bodies. And every group has a different kind of terrain that they explore what the trauma of this, you know, collective experience around white supremacy has done for folks. And that experience was so illuminating for me because we've never had that kind of process of reconciliation and recognition of the tremendousness of the pain and violence of caste in any of our contexts in South Asia, let alone using a process of something like the caste soul wound, which is what I wrote about, to look at the impacts of the nervous systems of dominant caste people from centuries of complicity, guilt, shame, and inflicting violence on many, many Dalit peoples. And so I think that gives us a different opening for, you know, dominant caste people to enter the conversation, not above the experience of caste, but also as victims of caste and as people who are similarly encasted, struggling with very different experiences of caste stress, but for which they have very little tolerance for. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, in order for us to be able to annihilate caste and to end it, we have to be able to create pathways of conversations where dominant caste people have more training to be more emotionally intelligent around when their fragility is stopping the flow of civil rights, and for them to be better allies and really allow Dalit people to lead in a way where we're driving these conversations and these processes. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's going to be a difficult process and a journey that will certainly take some time to move, but it will be there, you know. And so, Redhima, to what you were speaking, I feel like we want to go to these tactical conversations about how we can look at land reform and have collective engagements with dominant caste people, but we actually are not able to have meaningful conversations with many dominant caste people because they still do this. You know, even when you start to get into partnerships, you see bad things kind of reoccur because they're not self-reflective. And this is why movements like the Movement for Black Lives or other, you know, Black movements, they have a shared space with other communities of color, but they also create their own separate self-determined spaces so they can have internal conversations about what is needed, you know. And that's a really critical and important thing to kind of move in formation in that way. And so, you know, and I would say that there are many people who are more experienced than me that would talk about land reform. But I would say that in some ways, I wanted to focus and dial in on this psychosocial component, because this is one of the biggest inhibitors for us to create intercaste and interfaith spaces that are authentically intercaste and interfaith. And we've been doing so many experiments around this with our Unlearning Caste Supremacy workshop at Equality Labs that I've seen a whole generation of new leaders come out of that who are behaving and driving and entering into these conversations much differently.
Mm. I had a question, or rather a quick reflection. And I know, Vivek, you have a question that can follow this. Mm-hmm. One image that I had in mind when you were talking about fragility is, to Baldwin, because Baldwin talks about this, but it was an example on Wikipedia, it's called the New Orleans School Desegregation Crisis in 1954. And essentially it's when, I believe three or four, young Black girls were going to start to go to school at the school that was formerly completely segregated. So it was an all-white school. And the image that I have in mind is the protests of like white people who were around that school, like obviously yelling the smears, the N-word, yelling slurs, I mean, and death threats and so on. And that one of the girls, if I remember correctly, had like even three like U.S. field marshals who had to walk with her to even enter the school. And presumably they stayed with her throughout and whatnot. And this image just came to my mind of like how dangerous was it for the white supremacist worldview to even have even conceptualize the fact that, well, black people can also have an education, can also think for themselves, can also be educated, right? And they were so quite literally triggered. I mean, I think that's the term to use, that they were willing to stop, you know, three girls from attending a school. And you had like grown adults, you know, in their 60s, 70s in some cases, and hundreds if not thousands of them taking time out of their lives to take a stand as they saw it. And I've been thinking about this a lot, I mean, on and off for the past few years since I saw that initial footage of kind of it representing the embodiment of this fragility. Now, okay, all that being said, I know, Vivek, that you wanted to talk about kind of the diaspora angle a bit more, right? So just feel free to go for it if you want.
Yeah, I mean, I think adding to what Joey was saying, I think one of the phrasing that you use in the book that I thought was just captured it so perfectly was the escalation of emotions. And so that, because I've seen this personally when I've had conversations with other South Asians about this too, but it's just, I also notice this, you know, like when you're having conversations with family members also, it's just this, there's this defensiveness that comes to the fore. And it reminded me of something that Toni Morrison said, which was about, like, she was talking about an anecdote of, I think it was her as a child, and how she used to have this white boy who was a friend of hers, you know, like when they were really small. And then one day, this boy doesn't sit with her in the class, and because that boy's parents had told that it's not okay to sit with a black girl. And she said that that day, that boy learned to hate people, and the profound kind of damage that does to a person when you have to ask someone to start learning to hate someone else. And so I was wondering, this ties into one of the things that you mentioned in terms of like the kind of bigotry that's so ridiculous that you have experienced, essentially just to prevent any form of caste-based discrimination. And so I think the word that's used is Hindu phobia, which I think is quite insidious because it uses the language of the very real problem of Islamophobia, as well as the imagery of anti-Semitism. So I'm just wondering if you could speak to some of these themes.
Well, again, I think that what is really important, and this is again why I focused on this through the lens of trauma, is that, you know, dominant caste people's discomfort and fragility with the prospect of Dalit people achieving caste equity is a problem rooted in the centuries of the training of their nervous systems. It is absolutely intolerable for them to sit at the table with, for some of those folks, especially for folks that have been very used to using slurs. Because, you know, the things that dominant caste people do behind closed doors and how they speak about Dalit people is terrifying. You know, I have had other caste privileged people tell me what goes on with their families, and it's heartbreaking, you know. And so this is a pernicious form of discrimination and bigotry and violence that has not really gotten its due in terms of being fully aired out in our community, you know, especially in this way, you know, because the cultural practices like are so vicious, you know, especially as they've been recreated in the diaspora. And it is traumatizing. Like, you know, I was talking to this one girl in Toronto about how she was friends with someone and they went to like a restaurant and her friend, you know, ordered a vegetarian sandwich and she ended up choosing a meat sandwich. And she's like, why are you eating meat? And she's like, oh, because I'm Dalit. She just casually said it because she's like born here. She doesn't care. Right. And in the context of her sharing that with her friend says, oh, I'm not going to be able to bring you home because I don't think my parents would be think you're worthy to meet them. And they don't approve of intercaste and interreligious friendships. This is in Toronto. And mm-hmm. her feelings were so, she was really hurt. And then she realized, you know what? Actually, you know, this is part of the problem because like the reason why her friend is so terrified about bringing her home is because her sister was in an intercaste interfaith relationship and her parents beat her sister for being in that relationship. And then she said, you know, a lot of my friends tell me that their parents beat them when they go and they break caste and religious lines. And I think that this is not to make generalizations of any one community. I mean, gender-based violence and family violence is in all of our spaces. But what I'm saying is that in the diaspora, there is no reason to have such ferocity of maintaining caste and religious purity. And the fact that families and parents are doing that and weighing in so heavily on, you know, children to train them in these casteist mindsets, it's very, very troubling, you know, and we've heard many reports of children experiencing discrimination, of parents. You know, there's this one school in Chicago where parents have broken up their WhatsApp groups by the Brahmin parent group, the Kshatriya parent group, the Vaishya parent group. So it starts in the home, all right, and then it goes to workplaces, and then it goes to other community institutions. All the while, our communities are saying, there's no caste here. If there's no caste here, why is there a Brahmin Samaj of North America? You know, so what we've seen in our Unlearning Caste Supremacy workshop is there's a lot of dominant caste people who actually are very troubled by the conditioning that they've received around issues of caste and other religious communities as they've grown up. And so they needed a safe place to unpack it with other people of privilege, because it is, you know, when you grow up in a bigoted household, you know, it's embarrassing. Maybe there's also abuse going on. There might be like a million things that are going on, you know, and it doesn't feel like it should be a thing that you unpack with other Dalit or caste oppressed people, but you do need to unpack it in a collective container because it is messed up. You know, mm-hmm. you know, some of the stories I've heard, and many people take our workshop are survivors of domestic violence or gender-based violence in their home. And I think that's why they're willing to kind of confront the Brahminical patriarchy that they see there. But, you know, there's this one story, and this is not, I've heard many stories like this, where a girl came home with someone that was intercaste or multiracial. The parents didn't like it, and then they locked them up and didn't let them go to school, didn't let them to go outside the house because they were ruining the family's honor, you know? So these are very, very troubling things that have been brought forward that we need to address in a meaningful way, you know?
Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much.
I have so many thoughts, so many thoughts and feelings, not all of them coherent. And we can cut this if you're not comfortable with this, so honestly, feel free. But I'm very curious about, there is something that I learned in like my own personal experience of growing up in a context like Lebanon's, which is where I grew up, and learning at some point down the line that I was X, that I was a group, you know, assigned at birth, essentially, in my case, like Maronite, Catholic, whatever. And that there are other people sharing the same piece of land that were assigned something else, you know, Sunni, Shia, Druze, whatever, Orthodox, etc. That realization, I've been kind of trying to understand it a bit more, and it's not kind of, it's not going to be the topic of for this conversation. It's more something I'll do eventually, probably. But it also reminded me again to bring in Baldwin again of when he realized that he was black. He didn't know essentially when he was born that there is such a thing as, you know, what we would call black, white, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it goes back to what Vivek, you're saying, like, you know, how one learns to hate and so on. In his case, it was, he learned what his position was in society, i.e. he learned about the society that he grew up in, that he was born into, I mean. And the quintessential example that he gave, and this is one thing that I've mentioned a few times on this podcast as well, is he was watching one of those old like Western movies, like, you know, cowboy versus Native Americans and so on. And he was, at the time when he was very young, he was rooting for the cowboy. He was rooting for the white man because he didn't know otherwise. This is how the movie is structured. The movie is structured as, you know, the good frontiersman, whatever, who is cool and smokes a cigarette and shoots guns, like, and all of that, basically shooting indiscriminately and massacring Native Americans, right? And it took him some time, at some age, I think he mentions when he has 6 or 7 and so on, until he understood that in this metaphor, he is closer to the Native American than he is to the cowboy. And he talked about this being also like a form of like both a realization, but also a pretty traumatic event. And so I'm wondering if, well, in this case, Redeemer and Temori, like to the extent that you want to share and you really don't have to, do you remember when you, when Temori, I think you do because I read the book, but do you remember when you first realized or understood that you were Dalit, like in which context that was, and like what can you tell us about it in terms of like how it well impacted your life, obviously, or lives, depending who wants to share.
Yes, well, I have these really funny kind of like bookmark moments that I talk about in the book, but I think for me, the journey around really grappling with my own identity as a Dalit person began when I had the talk with my mom. You know, and in talking about it with her, I, you know, I was so shocked because, you know, I had done this book report about the Bhopal disaster and, you know, read about untouchables and reading that word through a child's mind, I was like, what could make somebody so bad that they would be untouchable? I was so shocked by it, you know? And then when I talked to my mom and I asked her about what caste I was, you know, I thought we would be like some fancy caste. I didn't think we would be untouchable. And then when she told me we were, you know, and, you know, I thought, you know, when I asked her that question, she just looked so sad because she literally left behind caste. Both her and my dad did because they didn't want to be defined by this. And yet here her little girl is asking this question. And it's such a tender moment because you have to explain a very violent system to a very tender mind. And you don't want to hurt them further. And you also aren't sure, will talking about it cause more harm? Or, you know, what is the right path? There's no book for Dalit parents to deal with this problem, you know? They just have to kind of struggle through trying to humanize their family and protect them as much as they can in a very cruel and very violent world. And so in trying to talk about it with me, I thought she did a really good job. You know, because she said like caste was the lie of the wicked, but, you know, this is your caste, you're a Buddhian, but, you know, this doesn't matter. We're in America. Don't worry about it, honey. You know, but, you know, this is, you know, it's important to know where we come from, but it's not who we are. And, you know, yada, 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 you know, trying to lift it up, you know. But in my mind, learning about untouchables was very traumatic, especially because I was raised Hindu. So we were going to temple. You know, and so learning about that, I would think about it all. I was like, what could I have done in a past life? Was I a rapist? Was I a murderer? Was I a thief? Then you read these like Hindu scriptures, and I would now key into the parts that would talk about caste oppressed people, like the Shudras. And when I read them, I was like, I remember looking at the scripture and then looking away. I was like, did anybody else read this? Is my womb really the equivalent of a jackal's? You know, if women marry outside of the caste, will all hell come to earth? Like some of the assertions that were being made were so absurd in a very poignant, violent way. And yet there was no one else mirroring my embodied horror. It was just me in my child body trying to grapple with this very massive system, and also watching my parents live a lifetime in being in the closet and being afraid of being found out because of all the violence that they experienced. So it was like, as soon as I had that word, I had a key, you know, to understanding what was going on, but I didn't have enough of the systemic analysis. And I think my life's path, you know, was to basically try to understand this from all these different domains. And I think it's part of, you know, I think, you know, Dr. Ambedkar was a polymath because you have to work in every domain possible to understand and interrogate how caste operates. And certainly that's the reason why I work in all these different fields, because you're like, oh my God, caste is here too. Wait a minute, caste is here too. Are you kidding me? It's even here? What? You know, I mean, even the grocery stores, if you go to the grocery stores, you will see Brahmin sambar puri right next to Periyar sambar puri. Like, it, there's no domain where you're not seeing casted names, casted struggles. It's just, it's tremendous, you know.
Also, so many thoughts. I don't know, Vivek, Ridhima, did you want to add anything to this? I have a question, but I'll leave it for in a bit.
I mean, Joy, you are so...
The mic.
I got this time. So, because you also asked the question to me, so...
If you want, yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting because I would like to point... I mean, there have been multiple instances, but I think one which stuck to me is because also Tenmoy talks about like, oh, caste is also here. So something in that point, because for me, I also have always been a nerd. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, I was very nerdy. I would only love being with books all the time. I really didn't have friends and I was the classic nerd. And I really enjoyed being that. And because of that, I was always performing very well in the school. And I remember, like, I don't know which age it was, but I think it was a second or third grade. And I was always performing very well in school. And one day I remember my teacher taking, because I scored the highest in the class, my teacher took my exam sheet again because she wanted to reevaluate, did I actually score that? And she started asking me questions that, how did you solve this? How did you solve that? And I was very confused because I thought she was just saying that I had cheated or I had not done something well. So I was a bit confused, but then of course it was all fine. I went home and in a very light way, I was telling my mom that this happened. And she was extremely angry and she was very upset that this happened. But I never understood that instance, what happened. And I could feel there were some instances because I was also from a, like at the intersection level of being from an economically not so good background and also from a Dalit background. So, and in the community I was growing up, there was all kids of scientific how do you say, scientific officers. This is the Atomic Research Center of India. So everybody is from a very upper caste and especially mostly their, I mean, dominant caste. And I was clearly the only kid, a Dalit, economically backward kid who was doing actually very good. And this was something which I think nobody was able to understand, that what was happening and why was it happening and how was it happening? Was it even possible? So I was like a miracle for everyone. And clearly I was treated as one, I mean, in an interesting way, in a very appreciated way, but also in a very questioning way. And this all only came into picture when actually I was applying for my college and I had to say that I was an SC. My dad just came and ticked the box of SC, which is the scheduled caste, which is a reservation associated. And I was so perplexed because... like all the instances suddenly came into my head and I was like, what's happening? Like, I'm sure, I mean, the same as Tenmoy, that I felt like, no, I'm not that. No, it's not possible. And I'm not going to go through reservations. I had a big fight with my parents that I'm not going to apply for reservations because I'm a very smart kid. And this is the whole, which was So if you like, if I think about it, it's like a very skewed discussion. And my parents never told me till it was a form, and we never even had a conversation about it. But it was quite funny that I felt bad about applying for reservations or applying for something which was necessary for in the system. But I felt so ashamed with that identity, and it has taken after that at least 10 years to be not ashamed anymore. And accept openly that it's okay. But yeah, so it's just like it exists, you know that, and you don't know how to really navigate through it.
Mm-hmm. And this was in Mumbai, right, at the beginning?
No, I was actually in Indore. It's okay. in the central state of India.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing this. Again, so many thoughts. Maybe to go back slightly to the naming that we mentioned at the beginning of, even because, you know, in both of the examples that you gave, it reminded me of what Borden said, like it had to be told to him, right? Like he had to be told by someone else, essentially, that this is who you are. And a big part of reclaiming that or subverting that, challenging that, as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, is using one term over the other. So Dalit, in this case, over the term untouchable. In the case of Black folks, obviously using Black or African-American instead of the N-word. In case of like LGBTQ folks, using reclaiming the term queer from something which was previously seen as like, well, it was a synonym of bizarre or strange, right? To something like now it's like just an identity, LGBTQ. It's and the Q usually encompasses actually all of the above. Well, Vivek, I don't know if you had some thoughts first. I don't want
to... No, I just wanted to kind of chime in to what Ridhima had mentioned. I think one of the things, this is the conversation around reservations in India is just so pervasively dangerous. So reservations, I guess, is what we call for the equivalent of affirmative action, and it is demonized to a point where the discourse across the board, it doesn't matter whether it's just everyday conversations or on news channels, when we hear about the usage of the phrase affirmative action, at least in the US, we do tend to hear viewpoints talking about the fact that the reason why affirmative action measures were introduced, at least partially to address historical injustices. But that sort of discourse is so completely absent from the discourse in the mainstream in India. I just wanted to add that.
Thanks a lot for that. I wanted to ask a question about the question of religion. I won't get into it as much just because of time, and I wanted to get into something else as like I feel more important. And also because, Tenmori, you were on the podcast, the Conspirituality podcast, which is where I first heard of your work. And I would link it in the show notes and folks can listen to it, in which you get more into the structures of the spirituality, or at least how it's justified. If you can mention, at least in your own experience, because you mentioned, of course, you were raised Hindu and then at some point you converted to Buddhism and you talked about Buddhism in the book. I had no idea that there was an extraordinary number of people who converted in one day. I forgot what the number was to Buddhism as well.
Of thousands, yes.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like I couldn't visualize it. But who converted, to Buddhism as a way of, like, it's not just a spiritual conversion, right? Or a religious one. It's also like a social one. It's a way of leaving or rejecting Brahmanism. So I just wanted to ask if you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. So, you know, it's a very sensitive topic. And I think that because Dalits are so gaslit every time we talk about caste, we never really get a space to be authentically grounded in all of the different ways our humanity has been stripped. But I think even for me, as someone who is an expert on this and has worked on it for many years, I think it took writing this book for me to explicitly be able to say, I am a survivor of religious abuse and violence. And just that sentence is itself earth-shattering and has never really fundamentally been uttered and respected within broader South Asian society, because to acknowledge that is to acknowledge that our religious institutions have abused Dalits and shunned them for centuries. You know, because even though caste has its origins in Hindu scripture, the reality is that every single religious community, whether it's Christians or Jains or Muslims or Sikhs, it's not scripturally, you know, condoned, but the communities have reorganized themselves around casteist lines. And that's, again, goes back to that trauma of caste, where we mindlessly repeat the patterns we're trained in, even if we want to be our best selves, even if we change the laws, if we don't change our internal conditioning, nothing shifts. But for me, as a Dalit person, I realized that core wound for me of being seen as a spiritual criminal, being dispossessed of the realm of the spirit, was something that hobbled me a lot of my life. And that it's also what ironically made me a seeker. You know, I was, you know, by the time I was 18, I read every single religious book I could get my hands on, because I was trying to see, okay, is this the faith I could belong to? Does this where I could be? I was just, I was hungry for spiritual community while also really afraid of it, because communal spiritual experiences are what led to the ritual shunning of Dalit people. So there's just this big pain I think many of us who are Dalit have around our right to pursue our existential understanding of the place in the universe. And I thought about this a lot when I was writing this book, because, you know, when you talk to all these white people that come to India for spiritual enlightenment, they're just like, I just felt a calling, you know, I needed to eat, pray, and love my way to nirvana. They just drop $1,500 and they go to a yoga session and they come back in their bliss. And wouldn't that be great if caste oppressed people could do that? You know, but we can't, because each one of these traditions tell us that we are spiritually unworthy. And that means that the journey for our existential process isn't that we go out and look at the stars and say, who am I? We have to fight for our right to even be human, let alone part of the continuance of the universe. But I think that because we have really fought for that, there is a way that we bring a concentration of power and focus to the conversations of what survivors of religious abuse you know, have rights to do in terms of calling into question the bias at the hearts of many traditions. And with Matthew's podcast, those are all people who come out of yoga training and have confronted different aspects of cultish behavior and sexual abuse and, you know, and have tried to and have better tools now to understand caste at the heart of those lineages. And I think to talk about the fact that some of our religious communities of practice were biased is not denigrating what value people might have out of those traditions. It's simply acknowledging that these were traditions started by people. People have biases, and so we can adapt them. And all traditions are adaptable, right? Do you see people like doing all the things that are talked about in like yoga practice? Like, are people putting iron rods in their anuses? Are they eating 30-yard cloths to clean their bodies? No. You know what I mean? Like, it's all about adapting to the times. We too can adapt to the times and speak about how communities that practice dharmic, you know, lineages, you know, have a responsibility to both, you know, appreciate that they get benefit from these experiences, but also that they are practicing lineages that have created harm for caste oppressed people. And we have global traditions now that do land equity acknowledgements, racial equity acknowledgements. This is a time where caste equity acknowledges, because caste equity acknowledgements can do so much to creating welcoming spaces and Buddhist sanghas and in yoga studios to allow all bodies and all people to feel more present. Because I was very distracted whenever I'd go into these spaces, because I would be asked things that would put me in conflict with harm that I know had occurred to my ancestors. And I couldn't do that. So how could I surrender on the mat when I was surrendering the pain of my lineage? You know, and also many people who practice those traditions, they are seeing things that are wrong, but because those traditions are very dogmatic and hierarchical, they don't question, you know. And so that is a challenge, you know, and it's very troublesome to see. But owning the fact that you're a survivor of religious abuse really opens up the pathway to healing. And that's really the journey I think that is really important to name, is that because then you can claim the divine. You can claim all the things that you want, because all of us are connected to each other and the universe. But knowing that we don't have to rely on human, you know, mediated institutions that say only a certain people can be connected to God, whereas as opposed to having a democratic relationship to the divine, I think those are the conversations that caste-oppressed mystics and spiritual seekers have offered as they try to find new pathways for freedom for not just caste-oppressed people, but all people. So that key piece of being a survivor of religious abuse is a core pain, I think, for Dalit people. And the ways we examine it, the way that we organize around it, the way that we heal ourselves from it is very instrumental for other communities who have survived religious abuse.
Thanks a lot for that. It links up like pretty beautifully, I think, with kind of more or less my last question, at least on this topic, which is obviously on the concept of the idea of healing. You know, Ridhima, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that this entire thing, in many ways, you reading this book, thinking about these questions, all of this has been part of a healing process. And Tenmori, in the book, you write like the pace, and here I'm quoting, the pace dictated by capitalism, Brahmanism, white supremacy, social media, and even by each other's trauma, discourages consciousness, end quote. This is at the beginning of the book. And your last chapter, as it happens, is entitled The End of Caste. So there's clearly a vision of this not needing to be there forever, right? Like the oppression, it doesn't have to exist forever, these oppressive structures. And you also talk about the so-called RAIN framework. So I just, and let me, if it's okay, link it to another question, which is very related to this. So when we talk about the healing process, you also talk about the imaginary being the final frontier, as you call it. And this podcast, like one of the de facto themes of the kind of the conversations that I try to engage in, is about stuff like solar punk, indigenous futurism, Afrofuturisms, all of these different types of futurisms that take seriously the notion that we have to be able to train that muscle, essentially, to imagine the future in very concrete ways at times in order to be able to see it as realistic, as feasible. So can you talk a bit about maybe that link, and let me know if this wasn't too clear, like what is the role of the imagination or the imaginary in the healing process, and what's this framework that you talk about, the RAIN framework?
Well, so I think they're kind of two different things, because like, so first of all, like, but I'm so interested that you found that connection between them. So I would like to be in your brain, Joey, for a little bit. But for me, I think the RAIN framework was super informative for me. And for folks who don't know that, the RAIN framework comes from this Buddhist thinker named Ruth King. And she developed this model from her book, Mindful of Race, in order to really help people, you know, have a little bit more spaciousness and a little bit more mindfulness when it comes to dealing with racial stress. And I thought that was super helpful in terms of talking about caste stress, because one, we have no models for dealing with caste stress. In fact, you know, I think our operating mode for caste stress is like dishoom and then counter dishoom. That's it. There's nothing else. We just know how to fight and then refight, you know, kind of like spy versus spy, right? But I think that what Ruth was trying to offer, because she also has a similar analysis to Resma, in that, you know, bodies of privilege and bodies who are oppressed have different experiences of caste stress, I mean, racial stress. And as a result, if people haven't spent enough time creating slowness in their approach to that, they can often cause harm and recreate cycles of violence. So what RAIN stands for is recognize, allow, investigate, and nurture. So when an incident happens, like let's say someone uses a cast slur or they're undermining you at work, your normal training is like, bad things happen, I'm either going to fight, freeze, or flee. And you're going to do it from previous traumas and act in that very specific way. But what she does is like, she says, okay, let's first name that something bad has occurred. So take a breath. Then before acting, you just want to sit and allow the feeling, the trauma response to occur. So instead of like, you know, in our normal days, you have a microaggression or a violent thing, we're forced as people of color to just be like, okay, I don't have time for this. I got to get my job done. I'm going to go. But that experience is still embodied in us, right? So the allow means you want to let that feeling go. So if it's like tightness of chest, maybe your gut is feeling wobbly. Maybe you feel like you're shaky or you're anxious. So you want to let that trauma embodied experience just kind of flow through you. Let it finish its things without judgment, without interpretation, even without resistance. Just let it pass through you. Then you can investigate. So yeah, I know I felt really upset in this. I know that my teeth, you know, I ground my teeth. I know I clenched my fists, but you know, why? What is this? How am I relating to these perceptions? You know, because the other part of what Rain is doing is that it's basically saying, you know, I might be angry, but I am not my anger, which is actually very distinct, right? It's like I'm in a condition, I'm having an emotional condition, but I am not that emotional experience. So by investigating, you can learn a little bit about it. And then the end part for her Rain model is nurture, which I really loved because, you know, a lot of times, especially as Dalit women, we're expected to be the people that intervene for every bad thing that happens in our community. And it's exhausting, you know, and actually sometimes when an experience of racial or caste or gender stress comes up, the thing that needs to happen is that I need to be nurtured. You know, I need to go take a walk. This is not my job to fix the problem of systemic, you know, discrimination in the organization as much as they want BIPOC women to do that work. My job is to just do my job, but I'm going to go talk about it with my friend where I can have empathetic witness, or I'm going to go hug a tree, or maybe I am going to organize, but I'm not doing so without strategy, without support and flanking. I'm not moving from a place of triggered nervous system. I'm in a place where I'm regulated, I'm thoughtful, and I'm able to move with appropriate behavior. And that to me is so empowering. And I think using Rain in my life made me a strategic leader. It also made me see the points where my trauma was fueling, you know, conflicts that actually need to be de-escalated, and also where I was experiencing pain. Because as a Dalit woman leader, you face attacks everywhere. You face attacks from dominant caste people all the time. You know, and I've been called a terrorist. I've been called a Hindu phobe. I was called the Rachel Dolezal of Dalits, even though I was born Hindu and Christian. You know, people have tried to physically attack my parents, you know, and I've had to move into a safe house. But on top of that, we also have to deal with inner problems in our community, like patriarchy and the ways that Dalit women's leadership is often undermined by men who are operating under Brahminical patriarchal frameworks. And so that's also challenging. So it's like, you have a lot that you need to manage. And as a leader, it's always our job to lead with the best model of leadership that we can. And not all, you know, we don't always do our best, but we have to do what we can. And I think this tool really helped me be more self-reflectful, more kind, more empathetic where I could be, and do my best to that regard, you know? So I think the Rain model is super, super important towards that end. But the second part of your question, the imaginary question, you know, that is a piece I think that is so important, is that as dark as the systems of caste are, as dark as this political moment is in South Asia, where multiple democracies are crippling under religious ethno-nationalism, there's still hope. There's always hope, you know, and humans can't live without hope. And I think that the imaginary is such a crucial place for us to drop seeds of revolution, and that even in times when we're so deprived of rights, We can always be, you know, dreamers of resistance, even if it's only in our own minds. And I always remember, I forgot the name of that Turkish poet who was in jail, and he wrote an entire book while he was in jail, you know, just to try to keep himself sane. And I think for Dalit people, I always think about the fact for me, like, I'm an artifact of 1,000 generations of love. There's no way my ancestors ever had the kinds of freedoms and potential choices that I have, but they had love. They had love, and they had a dream of a vision of a daughter that would be free. And so think about all of the different things that had to occur to create, like my sister and myself, you know, how many mothers only ate half of a meal and saved the rest of the rice for their children? You know, what did they go without in order to make sure that they could push forward a future generation? And I think just like Dalits have that radical imagination of pushing the future generations forward, I also think another really powerful process around this is that we have like a very powerful ability to dream the world that we want, especially if we give ourselves permission to stop being firefighters of the problem and being architects and visionaries of the future. And, you know, and I think that's very hard because we are in a time where so many systems are in crisis. But even as we're having to salvage, you know, banks that are going under, you know, healthcare that is failing and piecing together mutual aid while like the state fails in supporting, you know, pandemic support, we still have people that are trying to steal the stars and steal the future. So we have to actually carve ourselves out time to be visionaries. And the imaginary is a beautiful place to do that, whether it's through, you know, Dalit and Afrofuturism, whether it's about creating manifestos for what the just transition looks like. You know, we cannot allow capital and systems like white supremacy and Brahmanism to tell us the only way is the same way, which is, you know, oppressed millions of people. You know, a just transition also has to include repair and remedy for the future. And so I think that's going to be really powerful if we can engage with the, you know, that Dalit feminist metaverse that I talked about, because there is a world where we can build loving kindness. There is a world where we can build mutual co-liberatory solidarities. We just have to believe in it long enough, you know? And so I think that idea that hope is this muscle that we're going to be continually building with each other, every thought experiment to freedom always yields more freedom.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for that. One sentence that I learned from, I believe it was one of the solarpunk stories that I was reading, is like, even when I don't have hope, I try and create it. I.e., like, when sometimes I'm not in the mood, which is pretty frequently, pretty common, pretty often, I mean, I still recognize that when I am feeling hope, when I am feeling good and so on, it's often because I've read something or I've seen something or I've listened to something, which reminded me that there is a reason to have hope and so on. And that is sometimes the case, that the person who is talking in this way may not actually be feeling it because, you know, of whatever the reason may be. And so this is something that I've been trying to take to heart, really, of like, even when I'm personally feeling, you know, potentially cynical, even, I try not to let that define what I say or what I do. It's not that I don't feel it or I deny when I'm feeling it, but it's just that I'm trying to not let something that I know is destructive, given that it's affecting me negatively, affect someone else negatively, given that I don't know, especially with a, you know, a platform like a podcast, I don't know how, what state of mind the person listening is in, right? So I wanted to ask, we kind of slowly wrap up, like, Ridhima and Vivek, if you have kind of like thoughts you want to share, and when you're done, I will ask Tenmori the usual book question that I ask every guest.
I actually made a note of some of the proverbs, which like literally highlighted them on my text right now, which are very powerful about the Dalit feminist metaverse, which you said. Mm-hmm. So like feel very much Octavia Butler vibes there and feeling very hopeful. Thanks a lot, because interestingly, yesterday I was having a conversation about how I've been feeling hopeless for a long time lately, and this is really powerful for that. So thanks a lot for that. So I would just want to say that.
Well, want to tell you that it's totally okay to feel despair. It is a despairful time. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I actually started this book because I was in a place of despair. You know, watching elders that you love and treasure being like, you know, just being so confused with like their life's work being erased in front of their eyes, you know. And, you know, I remember, you know, because like for those of us who are South Asian, this has been a tremendous arc of violence. You know, we ended 2019 with, you know, the rise of the genocidal project in India with the CAA, which is the Citizenship Amendment Act, which, you know, targeted Muslims and Dalits and other poor people and created a religious category for citizenship, which was tremendous. And then we went from that to a pandemic, to an uprising, and then a coup. And that's all just in 2021, right? but I think that the conditions in India are so dire, and South Asia are so, they're just heartbreaking. And I remember my dad staying up to like 2 or 3 in the morning while things would decline, and he would be talking with other uncles, and then he couldn't sleep, and then he'd be watching documentaries about the Holocaust. And he was like, I was wondering, like, if we watch this, maybe we can find some solution to stop what's happening, you know? And I was like, Dad, your insomnia is not going to help you. You know, you shouldn't watch Nazi documentaries before you go to bed. But imagine like how much each of our bodies is trembling under the pressure of this moment. We see our futures being stolen from us. We see a nation and multiple peoples being destroyed. We see thousands of people as political prisoners. And we see this tremendous force that is a death cult coming for everybody. And that is terrifying, you know. But, you know, one of the things I did for this book, you know, which is not really for the faint of heart, but I read all of the testimonies of genocide that occurred in all of the South Asian genocides that I had heard of or knew of. So this included the Sri Lankan genocide, the Sikh genocide, the Myanmar genocide, the ongoing genocide that's going against Indian Muslims and Dalits and other folks. I read the testimonies from partition, as well as the testimonies from the Bangladeshi genocide. And they're harrowing, because you see all of these like death cults like kind of metastasize and unleash these projects of mass atrocity and death. And the acts that they're talking about are terrifying. The conditions are like the darkest parts of the human experience. And yet, even in that moment, there were people of courage who took a chance. Some chance, and they held up a light in the time of the dark. Maybe it was that they helped to hide a child, you know, in a basement. Maybe they helped a family get out of the alley before the mob came. Maybe they gave testimony in order to stand fast. But there was never a moment in the darkness of the human condition that someone didn't come forward to say, no, I choose life. So I just think that any time that there's ever been the darkest parts of the human experience, there has always been people that carried the light. And I feel like with CAST, one of the things that's so challenging is that people actually know it's wrong, but they don't feel like they have the permission to step away from the dogmatism and from the strong networks of family, culture, and tradition that have said, if you step away from this, you're breaking our family, you're breaking our power. And I think we can say we want to stand for another notion of power. We want to stand for life. And it requires a tremendous amount of courage. And I think no one body can stop a genocide, but all of us collectively can. And I think that, you know, it requires so many different ways of being too, because like, for example, right now, if we want to sit down and talk about the people talk with the people who we are in opposition with around these issues, you know, it's terrifying because these are violent actors. The idea of trying to sit down into a reconciliation process with them is tremendously frightening. We don't know if they would harm us, right? But there are people who are their families and friends who could de-escalate them. So if they work to de-escalate them, if they said, we are not going to stand by and be complicit as you move this country to genocide, there's a chance that that de-escalation would allow us to then create pathways for not agreement, but at least a beginning towards a re-entry back to consensus. And that work is hard. It's super humbling because you have to step into places with people who are violent. And it's not for everybody. You have to have already done your work to be regulated, to be present. But the opposite of de-escalation is picking up the corpses. And that's why I'm saying there is such an urgently different reason why I'm asking for this. This is not from a place of like, I want to be kumbaya. And I believe that, you know, I don't want to look directly at what this violence is. I'm saying this is someone who's faced these violent actors directly, who had to go into a safe house, who's seen the hate. And I'm still saying I want to come to the field with love and empathy and compassion, because the alternative is that we saddle our children with another generation of violence. And when children come into a context where there's mass atrocity and genocide, that impacts them and several generations afterwards. And so we have to stop the cycle of violence somewhere. And it starts with our own hearts and our own bodies. And I think we are evolved enough to take on this challenge. And if we take on this challenge, we'll be prepared for the next layer of volatility that's going to come with climate instability. So these things like that we are struggling with, you know, we're basically given the puzzles that we need to unlock our capability to build greater collaboration at a time when our species needs to evolve or we will die. And so I think that it's a challenge, but I think everyone here who's listening is up to it, because ultimately, you know, I do believe that love is a higher law that we all can follow. And I see tremendous hope because I see that change every day with the people around me.
I'm just almost rather speechless because I'm just so moved by what you said. I just want to say I'm just deeply indebted to not just this book, but your body of work about the revolutionary grace with which that pervades every chapter of this work, and also the sort of practical exercises that you provide in the appendices. And also the way in which you talk about how you stand in the presence of your ancestors and pay tribute to the caste abolition ancestors. And as somebody who is working in education, and given that this recording is taking place at the end of March, I want to thank you again for being so pivotal in the creation of the Dalit History Month that is in the month of April too.
I actually didn't know that it started History Month soon. Cool.
Yes,
that
Joey, this, you were this on will come time out without on... knowing. How did you know it was freedom time?
This episode is going to come out in April, so that's perfect.
Yes, and I also think that with Dalit History Month, people need to know how important it is to celebrate this holiday, because caste oppressed people are under attack every day. So celebrating us and connecting us to the global conversation of equity is one of the best things that people can do to fight and be part of the caste abolitionist movement. Because if I were to leave your listeners with a couple of like take home assignments, the first thing is that if you're in an institution and you are able to advocate for protected categories, see if you can add caste as a protected category. And if you get that win, then tag us at Equality Lab so we can lift that up. Because everywhere that we are able to globalize this conversation on caste, that is a win and a flanking of support for caste oppressed people everywhere. The second thing is doing exactly what Vivek was talking about, which is celebrate Dalit History Month. Learn and invite Dalit speakers to your community and connect with Dalit knowledge and change makers, because that's a way that we start to knit even further our movements as we go forward. And the other thing that I would ask is for folks to think about, you know, building, you know, caste DEI workshops and training so that you can, once you've changed the policy, you're able to really transform those institutions in a meaningful way collaboratively with like the Dalit communities and organizations in your institutions. So in either case, really looking forward to seeing how you move and take it forward. And we'll be very excited to see the ways that this conversation grows and spreads more commitments to caste abolition and healing.
Amazing. And like, speaking of homework, what are three books that you would recommend, Tenmori?
Oh, what three other books would I recommend? Okay, so I would definitely recommend Resma Menakem's book, Remembering My Grandmother's Hands. I love that book. I would also recommend Annihilation of Caste. That's like a foundational text by Dr. Ambedkar, which is a really beautiful entry for anyone related to caste struggle. And then another third book that I would recommend would be Debrahmanizing History. That is an amazing book. It's very dense. So I would almost like, you know, it's the kind of book that you have to read slowly, you know, digest the sentences, because he packs a lot into that book, you know. But that was the book that like cracked open the sky for me, because once I read that book, I understood, you know, there's a line that Dr. Ambedkar says where he says the history of South Asia is the history of revolution and counter-revolution, because of how many attempts caste oppressed people have made to get out of Brahmanism and to stop this violence. But, you know, to really see it laid out in as a succinct package that that Debrahmanizing History does. It's amazing. And all of those books are offered as in the bibliography for my book. So I really hope my book is basically a jumping off point for even more anti-caste scholarly work that folks might be doing, and really love the engagement that people have. Because once they read my book, then they come back to me and say, oh my gosh, this is really like this book and this book. So really good books, I think, open up even more beloved community for these ideas. So thank you for that question.
For sure. And yeah, thanks a lot for the recommendation. As with always, I will try and mention, I will include the books in the show notes and the description on the website as well. And I will try and remember all of the other resources we mentioned throughout this conversation and put them there as well. All that's left for me to say, honestly, is Tenmori, thanks a lot for this conversation. It was really fantastic. Vivek and Ridhima, thanks a lot also for joining in.
Thank you.
Of course, thank you.
Defy These Times is hosted by myself, Joey Ayu. I am also its producer, researcher, writer, and sound editor. If you want to help turn this project into a full-time job, please head out to patreon.com/firethesetimes to support it. These episodes are part of a bigger project which includes resources, a newsletter, and eventually YouTube video essays as well. As always, thank you for listening and take care.